be a part, be engaged, be an American.
Alaskans turn up around the state and in the nation's capital to support women's rights. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the third prize for the winner of the Kuskokwim 300.
I could feel the power in the handlebar, and I kind of knew at that point if we could keep that going, we would have a hard time catching us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaskans held local women's marches across the state on Saturday, from Adak to Utqiagvik to Homer to Ketchikan. An estimated 10,000 people participated statewide. For most, attending the march was an opportunity to stand up for women's rights, indigenous rights, environmental protection, and other social issues. But as Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman reports, it was just the first step.
People braved blizzards, negative temperatures, and strong winds to attend the marches statewide. Events were organized around the world in response to the negative rhetoric of President Donald Trump's campaign and potential threats to the rights of women, immigrants, people of faith, people of color, and many others. In the far north, about 100 people marched in the negative 23-degree weather in Nome. Dozens turned out despite similar temperatures in Utqiagvik, where some residents say the march was arranged last minute. 10 turned out in Adak in the far western Aleutians, 900 in Homer in the southern Kenai Peninsula. In Haines, in southeast Alaska, organizers expected 25 people to show up for the march, but instead, trumpeter and assembly member Tom Morfitt played to a crowd of about 150. Haines High School teacher Patty Brown was one of the participants. She says she'll continue the spirit of the march by helping her students learn to educate themselves.
I guess as much as anything, try to fill my students with interest in knowing facts and how to find them and how to research them and on their own do original science.
Marcy Ugsted was in a crowd of about 220 people in Ketchikan. She says for her, the march was about standing together for everyone's rights, no matter what their opinions are. Ugsted says the best way to continue forward is to get involved with the community.
Help out where you can, volunteer when you can, even if you only have an hour a week or 2 hours a week. There are so many local programs that need assistance. Be a part, be engaged, be an American.
In Sitka, Sitka Conservation Society Director Andrew Toms participated in the march and a direct action fair, along with 700 others. He was there gathering signatures to protect public lands.
Commercial fishermen are going back to Washington to advocate for federal lands and our salmon and fisheries resources, and we're going to send them back with a list of people who support keeping Tongass National Forest lands intact.
Some of the estimated 3,500 marchers in Anchorage echoed Tom's ideas and encouraged people to write to their elected leaders with their thoughts and concerns. Anchorage resident Whitney Flores says she'll continue the spirit of the march through her work.
To be a good policy writer, that's my plan, is being able to bridge the gap between science and policy so that way we can have good policy that benefits everybody.
Up the road in Talkeetna, where about 80 people participated, Sarah Kehoe said she plans to use compassion to help people protect their rights and stay safe.
And I think it's important still to speak out and express a different opinion and to stand up, particularly stand up for those that don't have the privilege. I understand I am white and I'm privileged, and I want to make sure that I go up to someone who's being bullied and I stand by them and I say, I'm here with you and I'm going to stay with you and be with you until you're safe.
Sarah Harrington, one of the organizers of Kodiak's 300-person march, echoed the ideas of supporting one another as a community.
We really wanted to bring everyone together and find commonalities. So have a way to unite people, but have people feel supported with some of the concerns that they have. right now. So we're definitely taking a positive stance.
With help from Abby Collins and Haynes, Layla Carey and Ketchikan, Emily Kwong and Sitka, Philip Manning and Talkeetna, and Kayla DeRoche and Kodiak, I'm Ann Hillman in Anchorage.
Thousands marched in Alaska, but hundreds of Alaskans also flew across the country to participate in the Women's March in Washington, D.C. Estimates put it as one of the largest in the capital's history. APRN's Liz Ruskin stuck close to one Alaskan and reports what began as activism became an endurance test.
Good morning! The crowds are really big, which is great, but we're advising people then to go down this side street a block or two. You'll have an easier time getting into the rally.
By 9 a.m., there were already signs that this march was going to be much larger than planned.
Go straight.
Juno attorney and blogger Libby Bacalar came with friends from Juno and Ketchikan. They planned to meet a larger group of Alaskans at the Smithsonian Museum of the American Indian. That didn't happen.
Yeah, I tried to beckon the rest of our crew back here, but I think they kind of got swept away in that zone, so... I don't know where they all are, but there's people from Anchorage, Fairbanks. There's like 600 of us here or something.
Bacalar spent most of the day hemmed in between two museums along the National Mall. The entire street was packed, wall to wall. Bacalar wore a vinyl banner that covered her body, shoulder to knee.
It says, we're from Alaska, and we can see Russia from the White House.
Just then, a protester dressed as Wonder Woman approached, drawn by the word Alaska.
Oh, nice to meet you. My name's Joanna. I'm from Sitka.
You are?
Hi.
Nice.
That's how it was all day long. People would see the Alaska sign and reveal their own connections to Alaska, or just thank Bacalar for coming from so far. As Gloria Steinem, Ashley Judd, and Alicia Keys rallied the pink-hatted masses, Bacalar said she is sympathetic to Trump fans who feel the economy has left them behind.
I mean, I think they're getting conned, and I think they're going to find that out the hard way, unfortunately. I think their problems are extremely real and serious, and he's just not the answer to those problems.
Bacalar was with a new friend, Missy O'Keefe, from New Jersey. They started out the morning with their mutual friend, Carrie Willoughby of Juno, but they lost Carrie early. And with so many people flooding the mall, cell phones barely worked. O'Keefe finally got word that Carrie might be near them.
How do you know where they are?
The Jumbotron, and Carrie's in a tree.
She's in a tree?
Yeah.
But there were lots of trees and lots of protesters up high in their branches. They couldn't find Carrie. At another point, Bacalar learned that one of her law school friends had somehow found a large group of Alaskans, and they were just on the other side of the nearest museum.
Okay, I'm going to try and find you. Okay. Hey, Missy. I think I'm going to go try and find the Alaska people. Do you want to try? No, the other ones. The big group of them.
They held hands and squeezed through the crowd. They made it about 20 feet.
Abort. Abort. We can't do it.
So they stayed roughly in place. By hour 4, the rally hadn't yet become a march. They were chilled, the crush of the crowd made Bacalar edgy, and nature's call was growing more urgent.
I wish I was wearing a diaper.
Word was, the intended march route was already jammed with people all the way to the White House. Still, Bacalar's spirits lifted whenever people responded to her banner.
Yay, thanks for coming from Alaska.
Sure.
Eventually, the human dam broke. It was more flood than march, with people going every which way. Bacalar found not only her Alaska friends, but her parents, who had come from New York to protest. Holly Handler of Juno said, whatever the discomforts, being in the crowd was kind of the point.
I wanted to be around people who had the same sense of reality that I do, and just to know that we're not alone and to be part of the numbers, to be counted.
Reporting from the National Mall, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Also over the weekend, mushers raced the Kuskokwim 300, and a winner was crowned on Sunday morning. As Anna Rose MacArthur reports, the K300 champion was no stranger to success.
His was the team to beat, and no one could. Sunday morning, for the third year in a row, Pete Kaiser won the 2017 Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race, crossing the finish line in Bethel just before 11 a.m. to loud cheers from his hometown crowd. His leader, Palmer, brought home the nine-dog team 28 minutes faster than last year. Kaiser was the first musher to leave the final upriver checkpoint of Tuluksak with a 20-minute edge over last year's runner-up, Brent Sass. At the finish line, Kaiser said the dog team signaled early in the run that they could make it home for the prize.
When we left Tuluksak, the dogs looked really good, and we were on step within a few miles, and I could feel the power in the handlebar, and I kind of knew at that point if we could keep that going, we were going to have a hard time catching us. So, but as far as, you know, knowing you're going to win, not until you get here. So,
a 29-year-old member of the next generation of mushers, Kaiser had 8 K300 finishes to his name. This year, he came into the race with an experienced core team who has raced the past 3 years. He also brought several up-and-coming 2-year-olds into his race team. Kaiser wins the $25,000 from the $150,000 purse. In a frigid race with temperatures reaching minus 40, Kaiser had to contend with a series of challenges.
Put a couple extra layers on and the dogs get coats, and a little extra care just makes every task a little bit more difficult. But it was nice to finally have a cold race with snow, and it actually felt like winter here.
36-year-old Sass, a seasoned Yukon Quest musher based in the interior community of Eureka, was never far behind Kaiser from Kalskag onward. Sass crossed the finish 46 minutes after Kaiser, taking second place to the Kuskokwim champion for the second year in a row.
He's a good dog musher, and these local guys are going to always be tough to beat. But I'm going to keep coming back and try.
The mushers' rest schedules match last year, when Sass chased Kaiser but was unable to overtake him in the final stretch. Richie Deal of Antioch placed third in the K300, his best career finish, and up one place from last year.
The core group, my dogs, just, you know, they're getting a little older and better at it. And, I could ask for much more, but they're pretty darn good.
In 2015, Kaiser became the first local musher in nearly 3 decades to win the Kuskokwim 300. Now he matches Mitch Seavey for the second most titles with 3. Only Jeff King, with 9 victories, has more. With help from Ben Matheson, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, no lichen, no problem. St. Paul Island reindeer show climate adaptability.
The reindeer are doing something really very interesting. They have managed to find other things to eat.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're a rural Alaska resident with an interest in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations, consider applying for a seat on a Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Deadline is Friday, February 3rd, 2017. More at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
A senior on the Soldotna High School hockey team was suspended from play over the weekend after posting racist comments on social media. The player was a team captain but did not participate in games in Anchorage. Posts on his personal Twitter account quickly went viral around the state, in which he made denigrating remarks about Alaska Natives, gay people, and the former First Family. The Kenai Peninsula Borough School District and Soldotna High School said the matter is being addressed and that the district, school, and hockey program are disappointed and troubled by the posts. Lawmakers are seeking to prevent law enforcement from requiring those accused of crimes and their family members or associates to forfeit their property before they're convicted. A bill introduced in the legislature, House Bill 42, is part of a national trend targeting what's known as civil asset forfeiture. Bill sponsor North Pole Representative Tammy Wilson says she wants to set up a legal process that will make it easier for people to keep their possessions.
This has to do with the belongings that are taken. They still can be seized, but now there will be a process for those who were not involved be able to get their items back without a lengthy proceeding and have to get an attorney to be able to do that.
Wilson gave an example of what the law is trying to prevent, a case where a person lends their car to a roommate who uses it to rob a liquor store. Wilson says the state could take the car under current law, but the bill would put the burden on the state to show the car owner was aware that it could be used in a crime. John Skidmore directs the Department of Law's Criminal Division. He says the state would benefit from making rules for forfeiting assets more uniform, but he says the bill goes too far in affecting cases where forfeiture would be appropriate.
The example that I've heard most frequently is the example of a flop house or an abandoned boat someplace, and the state has to actually take possession of it in order to remove it from where it is that nuisance.
Skidmore says he'll work with Wilson on the bill, which has attracted sponsors from both parties. The Drug Policy Alliance, a national group that advocates for easing drug laws, and the Resident Hunters of Alaska support the bill. For a long time, scientists have thought reindeer would be big losers in climate change. But the reindeer on St. Paul Island are challenging that theory. As their main winter food source has disappeared, the St. Paul herd has changed its diet so they can survive on the remote island. And as Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, this adaptation could have global implications for reindeer facing a warming climate.
If there's one fact everyone agrees on about reindeer, it's this.
No lichens, no reindeer.
That's Lauren Devine, co-director of the Aleut Community of St. Paul's Ecosystem Conservation Office.
Reindeer all over the world depend on lichen. They're very high in sugars and starch, and they're considered like a Snickers bar for reindeer in the winter.
Reindeer aren't native to Alaska. They were brought to rural villages, including those in the Pribilof Islands, in the early 1900s. The herd roams free, but like all reindeer, they are domesticated. When reindeer first came to St. Paul, there was lots of lichen, but the reindeer ate it faster than it could regrow on the small island, and now it's gone. But the reindeer are still there. There's about 400 of them. Devine was interested in managing the herd more formally, so in March of last year, she connected with Greg Finstad. He's the program manager for the University of Alaska Fairbanks Reindeer Research Program, and she invited him to visit. When Finstad got there, he saw something he'd never witnessed before.
The reindeer are doing something really very interesting. They have managed to find other things to eat. They've gone underground.
When examining the animals, Finstad discovered instead of lichen, reindeer on St. Paul are grazing on grass and digging up roots. Grass is rich in fiber, and their teeth are wearing down faster because they're eating more of it than typical reindeer. And based on the size of the animals, they're gigantic. Finstad can tell the herd is consuming a lot of protein. On St. Paul, the reindeer are responsible for decimating the lichen. They've literally eaten it all. Lichen is also disappearing around the world, but there's a different culprit, climate change. Finstad thinks what's happening on St. Paul could be a preview of how more northern herds may adapt to a warmer planet.
There's a lot of scientists, researchers, reindeer producers waving their arms in the world. Oh, climate change, it's the death of reindeer and caribou. But you know what? That we have forgotten to tell the reindeer and caribou, things change and they change with it.
Finstad used to worry about the future of reindeer, but what he's seen on St. Paul makes him optimistic that reindeer could deal with climate change just fine. But Mark Boyce, an ecology professor who studies caribou at the University of Alberta, isn't ready to make that leap.
I would say no. In that, I mean, it's an island population and a very small sample of our global populations of reindeer and caribou, and the general pattern has been one of decline. So I guess I'm not very optimistic.
Boyce says he's happy to hear some herds, like the one on St. Paul, might do better than expected, but he says overall the picture for reindeer is bleak. Finstad thinks skeptics like Boyce can be convinced if they visit the island and see the herd with their own eyes. Finstad has seen reindeer all around the world, and he says the St. Paul herd is exceptional.
These are beautiful, magnificent animals, large, healthy females, large antlers. And, you know, the antlers are as large as the males. The calves, they're large, very healthy, good-looking population.
Residents of St. Paul are taking full advantage of the herd. The community has mostly subsistence-hunted fur seal and seabirds, but Lauren Devine says there are now more reindeer hunters than anything on the island. The thriving reindeer herd is an especially important source of meat in a place where grocery prices are astronomical. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in St. Paul.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical cost. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The Fairbanks mayor's office says a former city police chief did have a conflict of interest that barred him from the job. Mayor Jim Matherly's office says the investigation into former Fairbanks police chief Randall Aragon's personal security survey business is complete and substantiated allegations of conflict of interest violations. Aragon was accused of using his position as police chief to promote his personal business. He resigned in October. Coming into the Country, John McPhee's book about Alaska, was published in 1977, introducing readers across the country to a wild place less than 20 years into its statehood. The book quickly became a bestseller and is still popular with tourists and Alaska residents alike. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Jennifer Pemberton has this story on what's enduring about the book.
Between 1975 and 77, a writer from Princeton, New Jersey, made four long trips to Alaska for a story that would eventually become Coming Into the Country. John McPhee had been writing for The New Yorker magazine for about 10 years. He was the master of a new literary genre that most modern readers are familiar with, creative nonfiction. Coming Into the Country is written in three parts, every word published first in the pages of The New Yorker, before coming together for the book's publication late in 1977. The book describes an Alaska both wild and settled, sometimes contentiously so.
It is about what McPhee came to believe was the real Alaska. And part of the reason for this book's continuing popularity is that many Alaskans also feel that that's the real Alaska.
Eric Heine is an English professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where he's been teaching Coming Into the Country since the late 1980s. The real Alaska, described in the book, is a place sparsely populated by trappers, prospectors, and squatters, living very much off the land and off the grid in the area around the Yukon River. Heine specializes in Alaskan literature, and so it makes sense to him that the profile of these characters is inherently relatable to so many Alaskans, then and now.
A lot of people still have an image in their heads of that Alaska being what they identify with. Mining, trapping, dog mushing, canoeing, homesteading.
For Alaskans, Coming Into the Country is familiar, but there's also an exoticism to the book that appeals to readers outside the state.
A lot of people still in the 1970s, they didn't know anything about Alaska. They didn't know much about the North Slope.
Alan Weltzien at the University of Western Montana is the closest thing academia has to a John McPhee scholar.
Part of what McPhee's trying to capture is its lure, and there's nothing more American than that. The lure is always to go west and find bigger space. I think Coming Into the Country is an invitation for some kinds of Americans, I suppose. Maybe just imaginative invitation more than actual one, probably to the relief of a lot of Alaskans.
Eric Heine agrees that the book is alluring to outsiders as well as requisite reading for anyone already living in the state.
I absolutely recommend it as the first book to read if you're coming to Alaska. It remains the best blend of comprehensive, accurate, and well-written. I mean, McPhee's a fabulous writer. There's no question about that. But also, as I said, it's remained remarkably accurate to today's Alaska.
The question of accuracy and relevancy comes up again and again when talking to people about coming into the country. For one, it was written 40 years ago. Hasn't Alaska changed since then? Also, the guy who wrote it is from Princeton, New Jersey. How could Alaskans possibly identify with that? Well, Professor Alan Weltzien hadn't even made it as far west as Montana when he read the book for the first time.
I distinctly remember feeling like I was having a love affair when I read Coming into the Country in the late 1970s. And I had this kind of trust in his representations. So I could ride along with him when he defined what the country means if you live in Alaska.
It's an old American tradition, the self-sufficient, independent individual. It's a myth we're all familiar with, but for as much as it reads like one, Coming into the Country isn't a novel. The characters are real, many of them still living in Alaska, some of them still in cabins they built with their own hands. Cable television is littered with reality shows about modern-day Alaskans living in the bush, but Eric Heine would rather go with McPhee's portrayal from 40 years ago.
What we get in the reality shows these days are sort of cartoonish portraits of the kind of people who live off the road system, on the edge of the road system, who have small minds, who run trap lines. What we get in McPhee's book is deeper portraits of the actual people.
At the end of the book, on his last trip to Alaska, John McPhee talks to one of the young prospectors on the Yukon, confirming his understanding of what Alaska represents and what this lifestyle means. In the society as a whole, he writes, there's an elemental need for a frontier outlet, for a pioneer place to go. People are mentioning outer space as, in this respect, all we have left. All we have left is Alaska. In some ways, all we have left is this book, as a snapshot from 1977 of a vastly unknown but very real place. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Zoe Sobel in St. Paul, Andrew Kitchenman and Jennifer Pemberton in Juneau, and Jenny Nyman in Homer. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
the 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com. Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.